Welcome back to Adventures in Theater History. In this episode, we continue the amazing, appalling, and the much too little known story of how the arrival in town of a play entitled The Klansman rocked Philadelphia back in 1906, and then later returned to rock the entire nation, and not in a good way. I'm going to talk about two things today to provide really important context about the background to our current storyline. I'm going to describe the life and career of Thomas Dixon, Jr., the author of The Klansman, because it's important to understand what a formidable person he was. He was not just a garden variety racist who had written a nasty little play. But before we even go there, I want to explore the way that the world of Philly theater was organized as a business back in the early 20th century, because it's important to make one other thing clear. Although much of the events we describe in these episodes happened at what was called the Walnut Street Theater, this has nothing to do with the modern Philadelphia producing organization of the same name. The current Walnut Street Theater, as an organization, is a nonprofit. It was founded in the 1980s, and although we in Philadelphia like to refer to it as the oldest theater in America, that's true only really in a limited sense. The building in 1906 was not the same as the structure that we know today, and it certainly was not the same in terms of management. It, like most theaters in Philadelphia, was controlled by the Theatrical Syndicate. I've been meaning for a while now to talk about the Syndicate, and this seems like as good a time as any. You may remember that as season one of the podcast came to a close, I ended the narration in the year 1897. Part of my reason for selecting that year as the end of 19th century theater was that it saw the advent of the motion picture in Philadelphia theaters, which was going to forever alter the structure of American entertainment. And the other reason was that the year before, in 1896, Philadelphia was the first American theater city to fall completely under control of the Syndicate. Now, the Theatrical Syndicate was the name of a group of businessmen who controlled most major theaters in America at the time. And all plays were booked by a central office in New York City, controlled by the producers, with the nefarious-sounding name of Erlanger and Claw. However, two Philadelphia businessmen had played a large part in the formation of the Syndicate. The first man was J. Fred Zimmerman. In 1863, at the age of 20, Zimmerman had started working at the very bottom of the ladder of Philadelphia showbiz as an usher in the newly constructed Third Chestnut Street Theater, the one west of 13th Street. Always good with numbers, Zimmerman soon caught the eye of upper management, and by 1868, he was the treasurer of an opera troupe, and then he became an advance agent, booking shows into the Chestnut. By 1880, he was running the Chestnut for its owner, William Haverly, and then he acquired the lease from him. In 1881, Zimmerman teamed up with another man, Samuel F. Nerdlinger, who had left his family's clothing business in Indiana and was now working for theater manager George Goodwin over at the Walnut as his right-hand man. Nerdlinger, as you may imagine, found his last name a bit too unwieldy for show business, so he adopted the name Samuel F. Nixon instead. When Goodwin suddenly died in the middle of 1881, Nixon and Zimmerman quickly sensed their opportunity. They persuaded Goodwin's widow to sell them the leases on both the Walnut Street Theater and the Chestnut Street Opera House nearby. Now they controlled three of the major theatrical venues in town: the Walnut Street Theater, the Chestnut Street Opera House, and the Chestnut Street Theater. And all American touring companies, as they came through Philadelphia, began to notice that to book their shows into town, it was best to keep on these two men's good side. By then, both Nixon and Zimmerman were extremely wealthy. They looked oddly alike, too, and they both wore the sweeping handlebar mustache that were popular in that era. By the mid-1890s, Nixon and Zimmerman had gotten control of the Broad Street Theater across from the Academy on the south side of town, as well as the new Park Theater on the corner of Ridge Avenue up on the north side. And they started buying up theaters elsewhere in Pennsylvania, as well as in West Virginia and in Ohio. And as we've mentioned previously, the theater business in the late 19th century was booming. And up till then, the theater business had largely been a cigars and a handshake kind of business, with men booking deals done on curbsides and in restaurants. But now the Nixon and Zimmerman office became quite a formidable barrier to any actor, manager, or touring troupe who wanted to bring their production to Philadelphia at all. You had to knock on their door. You had to sit across the desk from them and make a deal, and their deals were rough. As a team, they had the good cop, bad cop routine down, with Nixon being described by one actor manager who had to deal with him as a vain little person who could squeeze more juice out of a business orange than any man I have ever met, and I have met some squeezers. Zimmerman, for his part, was generally regarded as a genial and kinder person, but if you could not come to terms with him, what he would genially ask you was, well, could he just buy out your shares in your business instead? In 1896, these two Philadelphia theatrical tycoons found themselves at a luncheon at the Holland House in New York City, meeting with four of the biggest producers on Broadway: Al Haymon, who had interests in Chicago and San Francisco as well, George Frohman, who ran theaters in Brooklyn, Manhattan, and Boston, and that formidable duo of Abraham Lincoln Erlanger and Mark Claw, who controlled, well, everything else. Together, these six men realized they could do for the theater business what was being done in all other American industries of the day. They could control it, just like the titans of banking, steel, sugar, coal, railroads, etc. By coming to, well, a mutual understanding, they could rationalize booking policies, set prices, dictate wages to actors and fees to managers and playwrights. And in this pre-antitrust legislation era, this was completely legal. The theatrical syndicate was born. And the era of the great independent actor managers like Edwin Forrest, Edwin Booth, or Charlotte Cushman, who took their companies barnstorming across the country and renting theaters as they went, that was over. You had to work with the syndicate, and you had to agree to do a run in every one of their theaters across the country as you went. Or, you know, you could just not work at all. The members of the syndicate just kept gobbling up more and more theaters in cities large and small across the country. Now, for a while, a few of the biggest names in American theater fought back. Richard Mansfield, David Belasco, Fanny Davenport, Mrs. Fisk. But after a while, they all mostly had to give in. Everything in American showbiz was the syndicate. And you know, for the most part, theatergoers in Philadelphia didn't mind at all. All those delightful reviews, the operettas and the musical shows that everyone loved just kept cycling in and out of town. Ticket prices weren't really raised, and there was always plenty of entertainment available. All the big stars kept coming through town, from Sarah Bernhardt to Lillian Russell to Henry Irving and that brash new fellow, George M. Cohan. There were no more Philadelphia-based directors or playwrights or actors, true. Even all the Drews and the Barrymores had moved to New York, because from that point on, New York was where show business came from, as Frohman or Claw and Erlanger dispatched them out into the rest of the country. And down in Philadelphia, Nixon and Zimmerman just kept packing away the money, taking a hefty cut from every show that came through town. But what about the story we started to tell last time about Thomas Dixon Jr. and his play, The Klansman? How does he and this play all tie in with the theatrical syndicate? Okay, I'll get to that. But I gotta warn you, there is a much wilder story than I thought it would ever be when I started looking into it. Get ready, because here we go. Thomas Dixon Jr. was the most intellectually accomplished and politically driven playwright we have met in our adventures together on this podcast since, well, since the last intellectually accomplished and politically driven playwright, George Lepard, in our series of episodes about the Quaker City. But Dixon was not a Philadelphia man, not at all. Although he knew the northern states intimately and had lived and traveled in them for much of his adult life, Dixon was a son of the South and proud of it. Thomas Dixon Jr. was born in 1864 during the waning months of the American Civil War. His father, Thomas Dixon Sr., had brought the family back to the old homestead in Shelby, North Carolina, just north of the South Carolina border, after a grueling journey from Arkansas, where he had been living, during which three of his children had died. Dixon Sr. came from a family of substantial preachers, plantation owners, and Revolutionary War veterans. A considerable part of his holdings, of course, was in human beings, although Dixon Sr. always refused to sell any of his slaves that he had inherited on principle, even when he had a chance to do so. And Tom Jr. was just an infant, of course. The South was defeated. The enslaved people were liberated anyway, thankfully. But this left the Dixon family, for the moment, quite impoverished. As they struggled through the succeeding years, the occupying Union Army was not at all sympathetic to former white supporters of the Confederacy, and young Thomas and his four siblings found themselves working long hours in the family fields just to feed the household. A general sense of shame, humiliation, and defeat hung in the air. There were fearful rumors of huge migrations of freed blacks roaming the countryside, which caused the family to keep long nighttime vigils, their shotguns in hands. The general chaos, confusion, and resentment of the post-war era burned themselves into the young Tom's consciousness, literally from his earliest days. Both Dixon's father and his uncle, a former Confederate colonel named Leroy McAfee, had also been some of the chief organizers of the local chapter of the Ku Klux Klan, supposedly to maintain order and revive the honor in their part of the South. But in effect, their real mission was to reestablish white supremacy and political power and to terrorize black people. When he was just a boy, Tom had watched as a black man was lynched and murdered by a 1,500-strong hooded Klan mob on horseback. His dead body was then riddled with bullets. In the accounts I've read of this ghastly incident, I cannot tell if Dixon's father was part of the gang responsible for the lynching, but I think we can safely assume that he approved of it. His father could also be a stern authoritarian figure at home, too, driving all his children to succeed, demanding strict obedience, and once beating young Tom within an inch of his life when he discovered that the boy had agreed to go on an errand to buy a little whiskey for his grandmother. The Dixons were a highly intellectual family, however. Thomas's siblings were all bright, gifted, and ambitious, and as the Reconstruction period ended, they all found quite successful paths in life. His oldest brother, A.C. Dixon, became a well-known Baptist minister and a leading fundamentalist writer and theologian. His younger brother, Frank, though crippled and in need of crutches, became a leading public speaker and the president of the American Chautauqua Society. His sister Addie became an author of novels, and his other sister Delia went to medical school and became one of the first female physicians in the South. But the whole family agreed that Tom Dixon Jr. was the brightest one of them all. He only went to school for 2 years, but that was because that was all the school he needed. Tom blazed through the local Shelby Academy so quickly that they soon had nothing left to teach him. Exceptionally tall and gangly with coal-black hair and a wiry body from his time spent plowing the fields, Tom was determined to show everyone that he could succeed too. Accepted into Wake Forest College, like his brothers, he excelled in languages and in science, earned the highest academic scores ever awarded to a student at that time, and soon emerged with both his bachelor's and his master's degree at the age of 19. And then he was given a full scholarship to attend Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore to get his PhD in what was then the brand new field of political science. When he got to Johns Hopkins in the fall of 1884, at his very first seminar, he found himself sitting next to another bright fellow, a bespectacled Georgian and graduate of Princeton University, named Woodrow Wilson. Even though Wilson was 8 years older than Tom, the two became fast friends. And, ladies and gentlemen, here is a turn of events I bet you didn't see coming, because I sure didn't see it coming either. It was Woodrow Wilson who introduced the intense young North Carolinian to the world of the theater. The future U.S. president used to take Dixon along with him to the night spots of Baltimore in the evenings, and they were able to take in the touring companies that came through town. Lily Langtry, Joseph Jefferson, James O'Neill in The Count of Monte Cristo, Rose Itinge in A Winter's Tale, and even Sir Henry Irving and Ellen Terry in The Merchant of Venice. Now, being the sort of intense and enthusiastic person that he was, Thomas Dixon Jr. immediately decided that the theater was going to be his life's calling. Forget political science. He got hired by a Baltimore paper at the age of 19 to be their drama critic. But all those evenings spent watching plays only convinced him that he didn't want to write about plays. He wanted to be in plays. He had to become a Shakespearean actor. So in January 1884, he slipped away from his friend Mr. Wilson and from his studies at Johns Hopkins, and he took a train to New York City to find glory on the Great White Way. Dixon enrolled as a drama student at the Frobisher School of Drama and spent every evening watching plays at the Broadway theaters. And he was thrilled when he soon got an actual job in a touring company of Richard III. But it turned out to be one of those jobs where the actors had to invest in the company before they could go out on the road, with promises of a monetary return down the line. Dixon's family, with some trepidation, sent him the necessary $300 so he could join this troupe, only to find their fears confirmed when the theater manager immediately skipped town with all the cast's money. Desperately, young Tom started auditioning all over town to find other roles, only to finally be firmly told by a director that with his height of 6 feet 3.5 inches and his weight of only 150 pounds, he was just too odd-looking for the leading roles he supposedly wanted, and he was just uncastable. Give it up, kid. It had all been a terrible mistake. Young Tom Dixon's fever dream suddenly broke, and his ambitions of a glorious career in the theater were now in tatters. He got on a train back to North Carolina, chastened and defeated, having now become that most dangerous of all things, a failed actor. In the interest of time, I'm going to hurry through the next periods of Thomas Dixon's life. Though they are no less fascinating, he himself was always always in a hurry. He enrolled in law school down in North Carolina, and even before he was done, he got himself elected to the state legislature. He got married after a whirlwind courtship. He started practicing law for a while, hated it, and then, like his father and brother, he got a call to the pulpit. So he got religion. He was ordained as a Baptist minister, and now, with his frame starting to fill out and his intense look, his rich voice, and his piercing intellect, was soon receiving offers from congregations all over the country. He went from a congregation in Raleigh, North Carolina, to one in Boston, Massachusetts. And then he found himself back in Manhattan, now the minister of the 23rd Street Baptist Church, where his dynamic sermons were so wildly eclectic and popular that the congregation had to rent out a nearby YMCA auditorium just to handle the crowds. Because Dixon often spent his sermons haranguing his listeners about politics and social issues, he left that Baptist congregation to found his own independent church, which he called the People's Church. He also began an independent public speaking career, and again, was wildly popular everywhere he went, spending 3 years crisscrossing the country, advocating for temperance, for progressive politics, and a support for U.S. expansion into foreign affairs. In 1896, he was even an honored guest at the graduation ceremony of Philadelphia's Pierce College of Business at the Academy of Music. And by now, Dixon had bought a home in Virginia and was commuting back and forth to his congregation in New York by train. But in the end, it all just seemed too much to handle. In 1899, the exhaustingly restless Dixon gave up the ministry entirely and became a professional author, churning out endless articles, essays, and novels, especially novels. This was the great age of the lending library. There was always a market for more novels. It was also the great age of the theater, and Dixon kept going to see shows, like everybody else in America, and one night he found himself back in the theater again, always a dangerous place for him to be. And the play he went to see was not Shakespeare or some progressive-minded Ibsen play, folks. It was Uncle Tom's Cabin. Now, to you and me, if we know anything about our theater history, we know that by these early years of the 20th century, Uncle Tom's Cabin was a tired old chestnut of the play. Everyone had seen it dozens of times. It was rehashed and rewritten by hundreds of authors for hundreds of companies that used to play throughout America. It had very little to do with Harriet Beecher Stowe's original novel anymore, but it was a rather predictable parade of stock characterizations and well-known tropes, with the usual scenes of Eliza escaping across the Isy River, or a tear-jerking tableau of saintly little Eva rising up to heaven, and at the end, poor faithful Uncle Tom being beaten to death by the cruel slave master Simon Legree, all of it ending up in a scene of reconciliation and a promise for the eventual liberation for all people. But here's the thing. Thomas Dixon Jr. saw this play and thought, "This is outrageous. This is just so unfair to the South." Though paradoxically, Dixon rather much admired Abraham Lincoln, and even felt that ending slavery had been a necessity for a democratic nation. Dixon was also filled with a violent personal contempt for the entire black race, which he thought would only hold the rest of America back from its manifest destiny. So Dixon sat down and wrote another novel. It was called The Leopard's Spots, and it actually used characters from Uncle Tom's Cabin. Simon Legree now became a cynical white politician trying to profit off the South, and the light-skinned George Harris, the husband of Eliza, now educated at Harvard, was back in the South attempting to win the affections of a white lady. Dixon was terrified, in fact, at any prospect of what was then called miscegenation, a very ugly word, what we would now call perhaps interracial marriage or interracial relationships. All the black characters in Dixon's novel were depicted as subhuman characters. However, I gotta say, this was not at all an unusual attitude for white Americans at the time. And Dixon's rhetorical and writing talents were still insidiously strong about what many Philadelphia papers openly called the Negro question. The Leopard Spots, as a novel, was very popular. It sold so well, in fact, that Dixon set out to write another one, also placed in the Reconstruction South. And now he found that all his childhood memories, all his fears, all his resentments, all his sternly taught family lessons came flooding back to him. This one, this would be his masterpiece, he felt. He could finally tell the truths that he had witnessed from earliest childhood. He, in fact, felt he could write a truer history in a novel than any academic could write in some tired old treatise. This book, of course, would be The Klansman. As in his previous novel, in The Klansman, there is a theme of political humiliation, of racial peril from marauding and ignorant blacks, and political peril from mendacious and immoral white politicians, including one that was modeled on the historical character of Pennsylvania Congressman Thaddeus Stevens, whose memory Dixon hated with a special contempt, especially because, as was true, Stevens had a relationship with an African-American woman. At the end of the book, as you might have expected, the day was saved by the hooded knights of the South riding to the rescue. Dixon was paralyzed with fear at the thought of black political equality, but it was all tied into his fears of black social equality. To his mind, Southern white men were not the villain here. It was white Northerners who had come down after the war and tried to profit off the defeated South, and Reconstruction's attempt to give blacks the vote, Dixon felt, had proved a disaster and must never be allowed again. Because here's the thing. This was Dixon's reasoning, which he stated explicitly. If you have to ask a black man for his vote as a political equal, well then, as a democratic courtesy, you have to invite him to your dinner table as a social equal. And if you invite a black man to your dinner table, then you can't be surprised if he pays court to your sister. And that, he thought, that can never happen. That must not happen. He felt he had to warn the nation. When this novel, published in 1905, became a bestseller too, well, now Dixon felt empowered to return to his first love, the theater. Being the sort of person that he was, he took a quick correspondence course in how to write a play, and then, on the basis of that, in 6 weeks, Dixon had adapted his novel, The Klansman, into a melodrama that called for a huge company, a true spectacular. He was especially pleased with his plans for new lighting effects and supposedly scientific scenes in the play, which called for employing hypnotism and microscopes, as well as a troop of actual horses on the stage. Drawing on his national reputation, he signed up with a well-known New York literary agency, formed his own production company, and got, here they come back again, Erlanger and Claw to agree to book a tour of The Klansman throughout all their theaters that they controlled in the American South. To the theatrical syndicate, if a play was making money, then that's what a play was supposed to do. They really weren't interested in the morality or the political message of it. So off it went, packaged like all their many other plays. Though it met with considerable protest, let me tell you, from black journalists and political leaders in the South, during its run, it was a big hit down there with white audiences, and it toured from Charleston to Atlanta to Raleigh to Richmond. And Thomas Dixon Jr. was so, so happy. All the dreams of his youth were now redeemed, as he gleefully wrote. When the success of this play was assured beyond a doubt on the first night, the supreme consciousness of power over an audience was something I had never experienced before. For 15 years, I have lectured, often to crowds of 5,000 people. I know the feeling of an orator who holds an audience breathless on every word. And yet it was nothing compared to the joy of watching those people in the theater live with me in laughter and tears, in hisses and cheers, the scenes of my play. I dreamed myself a musician, the 50 actors on the stage, the living strings of a great harp which throbbed in unison with my own pulse beat as I swept the souls of my listeners. Next, Dixon planned. He knew he had another mission, to bring the Klansmen to the cities of the North as well. New York, Boston, Syracuse, and Philadelphia. Okay. Whew. Well, once again, I'm going to leave it there and come back to the rest of the story in a final episode. Let me tell you something, though. It's almost Christmas time, and I'm not sure I can get myself into the proper holiday mood if I have to keep all these books about Thomas Dixon Jr. around the house. So here's my plan. In 2 weeks' time, I'm going to give you a special holiday episode that will come out on the Friday between Christmas and New Year's Day. This will be a selection of some short and more charming stories dealing with Philly's theater history, just for a bit of relaxation and a change of pace. And then, in January, I'll return with the exciting conclusion of the fight against the Klansmen. And then, when we're done with that, in the coming year, we'll delve right back into the maelstrom, and I've got lots of stories of disputes, fights, riots, and lawsuits in Philly theater history, just like before. But for right now, let's take a break. It's been quite a year. Let's be good to each other. Please accept my best wishes to all you wonderful people for a joyous and peaceful time for you and for those you love. I'm Peter Schmitz, and our music and sound engineering are by Christopher Mark Colucci. Thank you once again for your kind attention. Please check out our social media feeds for the moment on Facebook and Instagram, and maybe you could consider sending a little love and financial support our way on Patreon, a lovely holiday gift, where there are all sorts of extra benefits waiting for you if you do. Please visit our website, www.aithpodcast.com, for additional images and blog posts and information, and to listen to our earlier episodes if you need to. And then, you know, like us and subscribe to our feed on whatever podcasting platform you are using right now. And leave a review. That's always so helpful. That would be a wonderful gift as well. Most of all, please join us again in a few weeks' time when we continue our adventures in theater history, Philadelphia.